Without much further ado, I will introduce Omar, who is also in the Sydney branch. He's a regular contributor to the Marxist Left Review, particularly on topics concerning the Middle East. So he wrote an article recently on the criminal Assad dynasty, and he's here to introduce the topic this morning, which is on Saudi Arabia versus Iran. So I'll leave it to him.
Yeah, so for the past two decades, politics in the Middle East has been shaped quite a lot by two major regional powers, Iran and Saudi Arabia. Now, their conflict is often presented in the media as a theological battle between Sunnis and Shiites that's been going for 1,400 years. But this is not a very useful or explanatory way of understanding what's going on. For one thing, the ruling classes of both countries have instrumentalized a very modern and particular version of each of their religious discourses to justify their kind of dominance over their own countries and over their own country and over the region. So Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia was only founded in the 18th century, and the interpretation of Shia Islam that justifies the Iranian regime was sort of loosely founded in the 18th century, but then really founded in 1970. So this is not some ancient theological battle, but something very contemporary. And so the religions and the kind of institutions of church and state which merge there, or mosque and state, are very modern and artificial constructions. And you can't explain the conflict in terms of religion, because probably the closest time these countries have been to each other was before the Shah of Iran was overthrown. And the Shah of Iran was a secular dictator who banned the hijab, encouraged miniskirts and all this kind of stuff. And the very conservative Wahhabi regime in Saudi Arabia were happy to work with him quite closely. So if religion can't explain this conflict, and I think it absolutely cannot, what can? And I would argue the Marxist theory of imperialism is absolutely necessary to make sense of why these countries act like they do. And so in this talk, I want to kind of touch on a few different things. I want to talk about the relationship to global US imperialism and US domination for each of the two countries and how that's affected their kind of role in the region. And then I want to look at their response to more recent events in the form of the Arab Spring and end on some of the domestic tensions and class struggles in the two countries. So imperialism is defined, I think, as a struggle between powerful capitalist nations for access to markets, materials, and resources at a global and regional level. And at a global level, the US and the USSR were the overwhelming players in the 20th century, or the latter half of the 20th century. And the US was, generally speaking, kingpin in the Middle East, using a constellation of political alliances, military bases, and financial interests to control the flow of oil and profits and power for much of the 20th century. Now, the US, even at its height, the US was never a master controlling every country in the world like a puppet. Countries had their own agendas, their competing rivalries and alliances, but operating within and shaped by the overall umbrella of US and Russian conflict. And even the US allies tended to have rivalries and so on to themselves. The Saudis were probably the key American state or kind of ally in the region. Along with Israel, it really formed the linchpin of their political strategies for the area. And they gave it all sorts of support, military support, economic support, political support. And the reason for this, of course, is that Saudi Arabia enjoys enormous oil reserves. And for much of the 20th century, oil, and still today really, oil is a key resource to control our global capitalism. And due to the enormous amount of oil that Saudi Arabia produced, which it would sell to America and other places, it enjoyed huge cash reserves, what they called petrodollars, which were then invested into America in the form of loans, which was a really crucial cycle, but also in the Middle East itself. And so in the Middle East and in America, Saudis were able to invest in capital and in political networks and organizations, which were kind of important for making Saudi Arabia a real nexus of imperial control over the region. And their alliance with America is based on real solid capital bonds. And the financial resources that Saudi Arabia enjoys was used to fund political organisations, but also religious organisations. So the Saudi Arabia has, you know, thousands of schools around the Middle East and more broadly, which teach a very particular brand of Islam, which they justify as their own regime. And so they've been able to influence political developments in the region in a number of ways, using these combined kind of economic and ideological tools. So, for example, at the height of kind of pan-Arabism in the 60s, Saudi Arabia was able to form a bloc called the Organization of Islamic States, Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which was the main organization which tried to cut off Arab nationalist, kind of left nationalist movement in the period, and to try and restore US dominance and preserve that, particularly against Jamal Abdel Nasser in Syria, in Egypt. They've also used their oil wealth and foreign direct investment to try and lure more oppositional, more radical, you know, supposedly radical Arab national states into the fold. And this is notable with the PLO, which is obviously not a state, but it is a sort of pseudo-state, wannabe state. They've been able to lure the PLO from a position of relative opposition to now one of total quiescence with Israel and America through their investments. Also Syria, under Assad, the father of the current Butcher and other countries like that. So the Saudis have been extremely proactive in the Middle East in kind of actively constructing American dominance and constructing alliances which preserve that system. And they do that in ways that Israel hasn't always been able to do. You're not allowed to be an ally with Israel for the most part, but being an ally of Saudi Arabia is an openly accepted thing and has been for many decades. But really, politically, it's a very similar kind of thing. Okay, Iran. Iran was an ally of the US for a substantial part of the 20th century, thanks to a brutal coup against a kind of nationalist leader in that country. So from 1953 to 1979, Iran enjoyed some of the largest foreign aid shipments, much like Israel receives today. Iran was the kind of predecessor to that. They enjoyed military support and all that kind of stuff. This all changed with the revolution in 1979. And it's worth saying this was not an Islamic revolution that it's talked about today. This was a genuine revolution made up of all sorts of political tendencies, a popular revolution, and in many aspects a workers' revolution, which unfortunately was then co-opted and kind of destroyed by the clerics. And so since then, Iran and the US have been generally oppositional. There are times when this has fluctuated, but in general, Iran has been oppositional to the US. And so this means that America has spent quite a fair bit of effort kind of containing and trying to undermine the Iranian regime, including a whole bunch of sanctions and horrific stuff that the left should absolutely oppose. Now, before talking about, I guess, the manifestations of the rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia, I just want to do a bit of a political economy of the two countries so people understand what we're talking about here. So after Turkey, which is sort of geopolitically in a sort of different space. Iran and Saudi Arabia are by far the biggest powers in the Middle Eastern region, like at a regional level. But they're quite different countries in many ways. So the Saudis have a substantially higher GDP, like much, much higher, due to their oil revenues. But their economy is far less balanced than that of Iran. Saudi Arabia basically produces oil, and then it produces things that immediately come from oil, like some plastics, some chemicals, and some cement. Basically, cement, the main ingredient of cement is just electricity. So Saudis produce a lot of that, but that's sort of mostly where it's at. And then they do a lot of financial services and trading. Iran, on the other hand, has a much more well-rounded economy. They produce cars, electronics, consumer goods, all sorts of stuff. It's a quite well-rounded economy. And even though it's kind of vulnerable because of years of sanctions and underinvestment and so on, it's a much more kind of proper economy. Okay, in terms of the population, Iran has 80 million people, while Saudi Arabia has about 30. But this figure is distorting because, like many of the Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia, you know, one-third of its population are migrant workers who are hyper-exploited, who do a lot of low-paid jobs, both domestically and in the construction sector and other things, which make up one-third of the population. So Saudi Arabia is a much smaller country in demographics terms than Iran. Militarily, a kind of similar pattern. Saudi Arabia, because it has so much more money and a close alliance with the US, enjoys massively better access to high-tech weaponry in the form of planes, you know, everything. There's no point going through it. They just enjoy everything that America has, the best of that. But as the joke goes, they have more fighter planes than they have pilots who can fly them. And so because Saudi Arabia has, until recently, not really been involved in serious military conflict in a mass sense, their military is quite under-experienced. Although the Yemeni population are bearing the brunt of that thing being turned around as we speak. In contrast, Iran has fought a number of wars and has a much larger, in terms of infantry and so on, military, with much more battle-hardened kind of leaders and soldiers. And I talked about religion earlier. Important to say, though, both countries have ethnic and religious minorities that are oppressed within. So in Saudi Arabia, there's between 15 and 25% of the population are Shiite Muslims who are extremely oppressed. And in Iran, only between 50 and 60% of the population are actually Persian. There's a number of Arabs, Azerbaijanis, Kurds, of course, and others. So both countries have to repress and actively police the minorities in their country in order to preserve their kind of presentation of themselves as Sunni and Shiite-only kind of states. Okay, so that's they're the kind of countries we're talking about. So in terms of the rivalry, I'm going to focus mostly on events since 2003. Because going back much further than that, it just gets a bit messy. So that's sort of what's defining politics at the moment. Relations between the two countries were transformed quite fundamentally by the Iraq War, by America's invasion of Iraq. And there's a reason for that, which is that Iraq has always been a kind of buffer country in the region between Iran and Saudi Arabia. When the Iranian Revolution happened, Iraq was the main sort of frontline actor to try and kind of defeat that. And so Iraq invaded Iran very soon after the revolution, and then the Iranian regime used Iraq as a kind of boogeyman to unite the population behind its oppressive kind of agenda. And so that was always a thing. When the first Gulf War happened, Iran supported it. So in 1991, the Iranian regime supported that war, which meant that they got a bunch of relations between the two countries warmed up. And they were officially recognised as a country with diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia. In 2003, they actually banned all demonstrations against the Iraq war in Iran, and they repressed people who tried to protest against America's invasion. Why is that? Well, partly it's because, again, since the Gulf War, there'd been a gradual re-establishment of relations with America and Saudi Arabia. And the Saudi, I think it was the Saudi king, actually visited Iran in 1999. But the other real reason, and I think this is more significant, is that Iran had relations with pretty much every oppositional force inside Iraq from decades ago. And so they calculated that once America overthrew Saddam, who was a brutal dictator and deserved to be overthrown, not by America, but once America got rid of Saddam, Iran would be in the best position to control the country and influence affairs from the outside. And that's what happened. So after the Americans invaded, destroyed the lives of millions of people, destroyed the country, there were movements against the Americans which threatened to unite Sunnis and Shiites and everyone else against the American occupation. The Iranians intervened to divide those movements, to promote the most sectarian, vicious form of Shiite supremacy kind of politics. And that is the politics now which runs the Iraqi government. And so the Iranian state really has enormous control over most of what happens in Iraq today. Now, this obviously concerned the Saudis. And so the Saudis then, in turn, began funding extreme kind of Sunni forces to counteract the Shiite ones. And so the Iraq war, really, to kind of summarize the effect of that, it normalized a level of brutality in the Middle East that really hadn't been seen before. The fact that, there's never been a situation, really, where a million people were killed in the space of a few years, like what happened in Iraq in the Middle East. That's not something that has been very common. It constructed an extreme sectarian dynamic in the region, which, again, there'd been sectarianism, definitely don't want to deny that, but the Iraq War really heightened and inflamed that, and it actually led to the growing of Iranian influence and the kind of concerning of the Saudis gaining more concern and the Americans being very much weakened. So that's the context, that's the aftermath of the Iraq War. And so Iran had sort of begun to step up onto the regional stage through that process. The next thing I really want to talk about is the Arab revolutions. The Arab revolutions, unlike often how they're talked about in the kind of conspiratorial internet world, were led by workers and the poor of the region in every country. These are revolutions, like most revolutions, caused by basic social and economic grievances by the vast majority of the populations. High food prices caused by speculation prior to and subsequent to the GFC. High unemployment, low wages, lack of political freedom, and a younger generation that knew it deserved better based on its access to global media, internet, and so on. But despite these incredibly inspiring and powerful revolutionary movements, they were all crushed eventually, unfortunately, by local capitalist classes at a domestic level, at a regional level, and by our global actors in the form of Russia and America. But again, unlike what is how it's often presented, the major actors were not, in fact, America. America was not the main actor in the whole process. I would argue Iran and Saudi Arabia were much more decisive to events than the US. And so I want to go through some of that. So in the Egyptian Revolution, for example, Mubarak, the dictator there, was a long-term US ally, really important US ally, and part of this Saudi nexus of states and politics that I was talking about earlier. But yet when the protests began, the Americans quickly made the calculation that it was worth sacrificing him in order to preserve the structure of the regime. And so Obama made pretty explicit support, not in the early days, but soon after that, for the protest movement, and basically supported the Muslim Brotherhood taking over that country and preserving pretty much the same politics at an economic and a political and an imperial level, but just with a kind of friendlier face, with a bit of democracy kind of covering. The Saudis hated that. The Saudis were against that from day one. They despised the Muslim Brotherhood, and so they acted and organized to sabotage the Muslim Brotherhood all the way through. They supported both kind of extremist clerics and Salafi movements who tried to undermine the Brotherhood, but also the military, and gave enormous money to the military to try and allow them to get back into power. And that's what ended up happening. In Bahrain, the revolution was incredibly heroic, and a revolution that's sort of underappreciated in many ways. And the Saudis really set the tone for what was to follow with their intervention into Bahrain. They just crushed it brutally. There was no kind of covering. It was no like, it was just like, no, just kill these people, occupy the roundabout, and just like drive them off the streets. And that's what happened. And this prefigured much of what was to come. In Syria, it's a bit more complicated. So I'll just briefly summarize. Like, the Americans never wanted regime change in Syria. Their best case scenario was keeping the regime but without Assad. Initially, they didn't even want to get rid of Assad. So the first 6 months of the revolution, they said Assad was a reformer, he's a great leader, he's a humanitarian unlike his father, he should just reform. If you Google Hillary Clinton, Obama, reform Syria, you'll find a number of speeches they gave in the first 6 months. In about August of 11, yeah, they changed their tune. And in that time, they said, okay, Assad has to step down. And so for a while they had that position, but they never did anything practical to support the revolution. In fact, their main contribution was to send CIA agents to the borders of Syria and stop genuine weapons going to the rebels. Now, meanwhile, the Syrians were brutalizing and butchering the protesters. And you can see this all on YouTube, peaceful demonstrations being shot at, and so on. In this context, self-defense became important, and the revolution had to arm itself in order to survive. The difficulty with this, though, was that in that context, finances and military resources become at a premium, and like we've seen in so many revolutions throughout history, the people who have access to the finances and to those weapons become very powerful. And so the Saudis began intervening to promote the most conservative spokespeople and the most kind of horrific kind of people to kind of lead or sort of hijack the revolution. So that was their contribution. On the Iranian side, again, it was a Saudi in Bahrain kind of style intervention. Crush, kill, destroy anybody who opposes the Syrian regime. And they were able to use sectarianism, violence, lies. They recruited people from all around the Middle East and extending as far as the Hazaras in Afghanistan, for example, and just everywhere. And they just basically gave them money to go fight in Syria on the basis of defending Shia Islam against Wahhabi terrorists, whatever. An extremely violent, sectarian, and horrific situation ensued. And alongside Russia's aerial support to the regime, the Iranian government's intervention is the only reason that the Syrian government survives to this day. Because of the popularity of the revolution, Assad was about to fall, but the Iranians and the Russians kept him alive. And so what we see through the Arab Spring is that both Saudi Arabia and Iran have absolutely zero interest in genuine democracy, in the kind of freedoms and rights that workers and the poor of the region absolutely deserve. And they both used both their soft power through religious networks and financial networks and hard power where necessary to crush any democratic possibilities. What we also see is that through the process, Iran was able to continue to expand its influence. In Syria, it now, again, controls the country, much like it does in Iraq. In Lebanon, Hezbollah's intervention into Syria has meant that Hezbollah, again, a kind of Shiite exclusive kind of supremacist party, very sectarian, has gained in power and relative strength in that country. So Iran now has more influence in Lebanon. In Qatar, like the Saudi kind of thing with Qatar has meant that Iran also has better relations with Qatar than it did before, and so on. And even in Palestine, actually, the defeat of the Arab Spring has meant Hamas has gone back to a kind of pro-Iranian position, which for a while it vacillated on. Okay, yeah. So I want to talk about the Iran deal, which Obama signed with Iran, obviously. The motivation. So as a result of what I've been saying, the Americans had noticed that Iran was gradually gaining control over a number of countries that are quite important in the Middle East. And so a wing of the American establishment, I think, decided to be pragmatic and to see the Iranian state as a potential someone to work with or at least begin dialogue with. There's a few reasons for this. In 2009, the Green Movement happened, which sort of eventually launched kind of reformers into power. And for those who don't know, the Iranian political system is sort of divided into two. There's the hardline, ultra-conservative, both socially and in every way, wing. And there's the liberal wing, which is also ultra-conservative, but are for the free market in a bit more explicit ways, and kind of use some very, very marginal socially liberal attitudes to justify that as well. So that kind of wing, the Rouhani wing of the regime was elected. And so the Americans thought, or some of the Americans thought, let's work with them, see what we can get through this process. There was always tensions to this. And you could see that through when the process was being negotiated. There was enormous sections of the American ruling class which was not happy with this plan. They were trained and schooled in Iran being the devil, and they really believed it. And they also understood that their long-term alliances with Israel and Saudi Arabia and other places couldn't be reconciled with an alliance with Iran. They understood the kind of the power in the Middle East and were not prepared to just ditch everything that had happened before, 50 years of imperial strategy, to just move to something different. And I think that's important because we see it here in Australia, you know, like there's some people who argue, oh, because we do so much business with, you know, China, there's just going to be this smooth transition, this rational choice, which one day is made, that Australia will just become an ally with China. But actually, imperialism and politics doesn't work that way. There are serious ideological and subjective and kind of structured economic and political relationships which can't just be overturned overnight. And so what we saw was a number of attacks on Obama from both the Democratic establishment and definitely from the Republican establishment for doing this deal. And it's not just the lunatics who are criticizing it. Hillary Clinton was quite opposed to it to begin with, even though during the election campaign she kind of softened her stance, largely because she ran on "I'm like Obama, not like Trump." But in a serious sense, she was quite opposed to the deal as it stood. And so I think now with Trump, I think the deal is pretty short-lived. It's not long for this world kind of thing. He's surrounded himself with the most extreme neoconservatives and worse. He's been talking about bombing Iran, isolating Iran, ripping up the deal. He's already endorsed the deal or whatever, which means that at any point Congress could decide to overturn it. I think it's not long for this world. And I think part of that is that America has a more aggressive strategy under Trump, which is about reasserting power in a typical like hard power sense of the word. So John Bolton has talked about preemptive strikes against both North Korea and Iran, and I think he's not joking about that. So I think it's quite possible, or really I'd say quite likely, that the deal will be torn up and some new round of aggression and counter-aggression between the two countries will emerge. And I think Saudi Arabia is a big part of that. And if you follow Saudi Arabian politics, you will know that there's been a bunch of talks of Saudi Arabia and Israel signing an open peace treaty, and all of that is about isolating Iran. On the other hand, if America goes down the path of war with North Korea, it might be that some saner heads think, let's not open two fronts simultaneously. So we can't predict anything too decisive, but definitely Iran or North Korea, I would suggest, are going to be a side of tension. And if it is Iran, then Saudi Arabia will have a big part to play in that. Okay, so far I've talked almost entirely about the kind of factors and contradictions shaping the decision-making of the ruling classes of the region. And that's important because imperialism is largely determined by that. But I guess I want to end by talking about the domestic tensions facing each country and some of the difficulties of the ruling classes in each of these kind of regional powers. And there's a few reasons for this. One is you can't really understand imperialism without understanding the domestic politics which drive it, both at an economic level, so the search for resources and markets and power and so on. But also on the positive side, that we should never rule out the agency of workers and the poor to shape historic events and challenge the best laid plans of their overlords. And right now there are really significant, although different, crises in each of the two countries. So in Iran, there have been substantial economic issues now for many, many years. The economy is in crisis after years of sanctions, really restrictive and extreme sanctions put on by America and I think the UN as well, which means that unemployment is high, investment is low. There's been a lot of discontent in that country. And part of the way that the kind of moderate wing of the regime sold the Iran deal with America, the deal with America, was on the basis of we're going to have a new round of investment, there'll be jobs, the economy will be boosted, and everyone will be better off. And people were open to that. But actually, the deal has not flowed through. The Americans have not lifted all the sanctions, even under Obama. The decision was not made to do that. And I'm sure that Trump, I think he maybe already has done it, or he definitely will be doing a new round of sanctions, squeezing again the government there. And so in response to that, what we've seen is quite a large wave of protests across the country. And these protests have been maligned by the regime and by kind of the conspiratorial, Assadist, Putinist kind of internet left as like products of American imperialism, as, you know, they're all stooges for the CIA or whatever. But these protests are fundamentally working class and poor and farmers protesting against a horrific, repressive neoliberal regime. Now, there was a massive protest that happened in December, but since then, those protests have run out of steam. But what we have seen are localized actions by workers and farmers across the country demanding better wages, better conditions, and their rights. Now, the difficulty this movement faces is that because the liberal or moderate wing of the regime is currently in power, they're receiving no support from the kind of middle-class intelligentsia of the country. So it's really a genuine working class movement, but it's receiving, you know, no one backs it. The right wing don't back it. The moderates in power, they don't back it. And so it's hard in that context to build a movement in places like Tehran, where there is a sizable regime presence and also a sizable kind of liberal middle class sort of presence. And so it's hard to know where that's going to develop from here. But what we do know is the regime is facing a rebellion, a widespread rebellion. And I think, as Rosa Luxemburg kind of theorized in the mass strike, sometimes this will be centralized and huge, other times it'll be diffuse and economic. But either way, I think the movement is sort of deepening and growing over time. And at some point in the future, Iran will face a domestic crisis. And we can only hope that they're able to get rid of the regime entirely. But who knows? In Saudi Arabia, things are different. There's not the same kind of, at all, protest movement against the regime. It's not that kind of crisis. But what there is an economic tension that's growing due to the relatively low price of oil, And so the kind of Saudi state, which is premised on enormous handouts to everyone and whatever, has been facing some difficulties. And so they've cut subsidies to sections of the population. They've privatized or are privatizing 50% of Aramco, the enormous oil company that was nationalized decades ago. And so that's an economic tension. Then on the political side, it's they're really feeling a sense of retreat, imperial retreat and entrapment by Iran. And so the new leader, MBS, has come in proposing a kind of attempt to break out of these shackles that Saudi Arabia has been in for some time, in a similar way to Trump, really, in terms of a massive escalation of imperial aggression. And so the war in Yemen was his idea as the Minister for Defense, and so on. And then also on an economic level. So firstly, he arrested a number of kind of billionaires in Saudi Arabia, locked them up in like a 5-star hotel and extorted them. He got $100 billion out of these people. I think it was 200 people, and he got $100 billion out of them, which is a great effort, something that a socialist state can one day emulate. But so he's doing that not to obviously spend that money on the population, but to amass more money for himself to then invest in the military and try and rejig the Saudi economy for the sake of a new round of accumulation and imperial expansion. Okay, to counteract the effect of these cuts that MBS has been putting through, and this has been talked about a lot in the media, he's made a few symbolic reforms which kind of appeal to a wealthy, educated, middle-class section of the Saudi population. And most dramatically, this was allowing women to drive, which is an enormous radical reform, according to the New York Times, indicative of a really revolutionary leader. This radical reform, however, has not been implemented yet. It was announced in, I think, September last year. It'll be implemented in June this year, which is, time for the people of Saudi Arabia to accustom themselves to such radical ideas as women driving. But to some extent, this is working, I think. Like, there is a section of Saudi Arabia's middle class, who enjoy a very good lifestyle, funded by oil, who also are modernizing and looking at the world and thinking and going overseas to places like Australia and America and going to university and kind of feeling like things should, people should have rights, women should have rights, they should be able to own companies too and exploit people and so on. At Sydney University, one of our members last week or 2 weeks ago did a lecture announcement in support of the Books Not Bombs protest that we had. And one of those things was to say, we're protesting against arms sales, which are going to Trump's America, which doesn't need any more guns, and to Saudi Arabia, which definitely is a repressive dictatorship, shouldn't be supported. A student got up, a young Muslim woman got up and said, "Excuse me, I'm from Saudi Arabia and I'm not oppressed." Harsha then replied by saying, "Well, the people of Yemen are oppressed, and there are millions of people in Saudi Arabia who are oppressed, so I think you should, just sit down." She then complained to the university, and the university sent us an email saying, "This breaches the code of conduct of the university to not bully and harass people in this campus." So, that's a different issue about free speech or whatever, but it's an important one. But there are clearly Saudi citizens who don't despise the kind of Trumpian, disgusting figure of MBS. And I think the imperial interventions of the Saudi government in Yemen and other places are also about building that domestic support. We know that nationalism is a powerful tool in this country, we know that, it is part of galvanizing the population for a new leadership. Okay, so in terms of just to wrap up, I think the general tendency in the last few decades, really, the last 20 years probably, is for Iran to gain more influence, to expand its sphere of operations, and for America and Saudi Arabia to be weakened. That is undeniable. However, there are real limits, I think, to this process, and we shouldn't treat it as just a linear, inevitable, eternal one. Iran, in the way that it operates, it does prefer to act through Shiite militias and sectarian Shiite organizations. There are not that many countries in the Middle East with substantial Shiite populations, and really they've reached, apart from Saudi Arabia with its 20% minority, the kind of Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon thing is really where it's at. They're going to struggle to use their organic connections beyond that. The other issues that Iran faces, of course, its own economic situation, which is not strong, and a domestic working class population, which is agitating. On the Saudi side, their positives are that they still enjoy an enormous economic power, and not just economic power in the terms of cash, but in terms of investment and imperial. Like, the Saudis basically run the Egyptian military, which is the most powerful military in the region. They have a huge stake in Lebanese banking system, in the banking system of the whole region. They have huge stakes in Palestine and Syria and a whole bunch of places. So the Saudis are not going away. And so we can't just assume that their kind of contraction will just be permanent. Then there's the factor of Trump, who is totally erratic and unpredictable. And I think that adds an element of instability to the whole situation. As we're seeing now with the promotion of John Bolton and Pompeo and so on, his whole approach is not to gradually fade American imperialism into the night, but to like jump up and down and try and reassert it in a very aggressive way. And we can't predict how that will play out, but I think it definitely will play out somewhere. And so that adds an element of instability, and meaning it makes it hard for Iran to just keep going. Now, as leftists, I think it's important to say that we have no stake in this horrific game of imperial chess. Neither side, Saudi Arabia or Iran, have anything to offer the people of the region. And I think that's important because there's a kind of crude anti-imperialism that goes around, again, mostly on the internet, which is sort of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So America is obviously the main power globally still by a long way, should be opposed by every progressive person on the planet. But some people fall into the trap of saying, well, anyone who opposes America is therefore somehow supportable. And I think the rise of Iran as a power in the last 15, 20 years or so is a really good example of why that's not a progressive thing necessarily. The rise of Iran has actually coincided with some of the most brutal, oppressive policies, which were initiated by the Americans, absolutely. But these regional powers are also bloodthirsty, self-interested actors, and will do whatever it takes to gain. So for our perspective, from a left perspective, we will always see the only anti-imperialist force, in a genuine sense, are workers and the poor of every region, of every country. And so while the situation today seems extremely grim, there is always hope for revolutionary upsurges. The issues and tensions and problems which triggered the Arab Spring 7 years ago now remain. We're seeing that in Iran. We're seeing that at the moment in actually the Kurdish parts of Iraq, where there's been big protests against the Kurdish government there, who have been failing to pay their workers' wages. And we'll definitely see it again in other parts of the Middle East. So that's where hope lies, not with Iran or Saudi Arabia.